for inviting us out to your house here on Webb Lake, and have a chance here on August 4th, 1986, to talk a little bit about Camp Kewaunee and how you first got involved in it. And so perhaps you can give us some of your early reminiscences.
Well, Ed, I'd be very delighted to, and it's so nice to have Mary and John out here also, and Jane will be here in just a few moments. As you probably know, my connection with Kewaunee is basically in two time segments. The initial contact with Camp Kewaunee was made in 1934, and I was here 34, 35, 36, 37, 38, 39, six seasons. And there was a gentleman up here by the name of Colonel Sweet, Sidney Sweet, who eventually became the Dean of the Cathedral in St. Louis and had been at Kewaunee many summers, was a close friend of George and Raymond Frank. And he is the one that told my parents about Camp Kewaunee. And my brother and I were enrolled up here. And at that point in time, I was, quote, an old man, quote, because I think I was close to 15 years of age when I first became introduced to Kewaunee. And my brother was 4 years younger, so he got more of the benefit of the program, really, than I did. I was taken as a master camper, and my first lodge was the Crow's Nest. Uh-huh. I had a gentleman by the name of Rafe Marshall as my senior counselor, and there were only a few of us in the lodge, so the Franks decided there was no need for a junior counselor. We had Rafe Marshall, period. Now, strangely enough, Rafe Marshall had a bad accident. He was thrown from a horse. You know, we had horses the first or second year that I was here, and then that was discontinued. But Rafe Marshall was thrown from a horse and badly injured, and was out for the season about the end of the first week of camp. So Raymond Frank came up and he talked to us, and I had Dick Bittenbender in my lodge at Crow's Nest, and John Marble and myself. And it seems to me there was a fellow named Patterson in there. Uh-huh. And that seems to be about it. We only had one or two other fellows in Crow right here. Uh-huh. So we, Mr. Raymond Frank contacted us, sat down and chatted with him. He said, now fellows, you're going to be without a counselor this year, and I'm putting the burden of responsibility directly upon your shoulders. Hmm. I, Raymond Frank, feel that you're a good bunch in here and you can handle it well. And as it turned out, we did handle it pretty well. I don't think we got into too much devilment all season long. We were basically a pretty good bunch of boys.
Good.
So that's the way we got started out. And so then, after I had been here, let's see, that was my first year. Then, the next year, I think I did reasonably well without the extra supervision. So Mr. George Frank came to me and he said, we're going to make you a JC. Mm-hmm. So we think you'd work well with the little kids. So they put me down as a JC in Eagle. Mm-hmm. And my senior counselor was Cam Scarlett.
Oh.
Remember Campbell Scarlett?
Oh, yes, I do. Very well.
So I was in Cam Scarlett's lodge as JC that year. And then apparently he must have needed senior counselors badly the next year, because I think he upped his senior counselor status. And I was a senior counselor in Pine Tree. Uh-huh. And then I was a senior counselor the rest of the time. Until I finished my junior year in college, and along about that time I got interested in archery, and there was a fellow by the name of Van Eeks up there.
Haven't heard of him.
Whom you probably would not know, but he was the archery instructor, and I worked for him a couple of summers. Then he couldn't come back, so George Frank said, well, we're going to pay you the magnificent sum of about $75 and put you at the head of the archery department. So this is what happened. And then I was head of archery for two or three summers, uh-huh. and had another lodge or two after that. See, after Pine, I was in Birch 1 year and as a senior counselor. And, you know, I can't remember what other lodge I was in, so, but that's about it. So I finished my first lap of my Kewanee career in 1939, and as a director of archery and as a lodge counselor. Then I forgot about Camp Kewanee for a number, didn't forget about it, I shouldn't say that. But I was not directly connected with Camp Kewanee for a number of years. I was in the steel business first for a year and a half, then was in the Navy for 3 years, then was in the textile business for 6 years, then back into the steel business for 4 years in Hamilton, Ohio, and my wife Jane and I lived in Hamilton, and I worked in Cincinnati for Central Steel and Wire Company, and then had an opportunity to go back to Columbus working for the Brown Steel Company. And at that time, we got back to Columbus roughly 30 years ago, and Mr. George Frank found out that we were back in Columbus and that we had three boys. So that involved a phone call, and eventually we signed up John Estabrook, our oldest son, who was in about 9 or 10. And he was here for 7 or 8 years, and then 2 years later, Richie Estabrook, our second son, who was up here about 10 years. And then Jimmy Estabrook, our deaf son, was eligible as far as age goes to become a camper at Camp Kewanee. And Mr. Frank called me about him, and so I said, well, Mr. Frank, I appreciate your offer to have our third son there, but two reasons. I find that it's getting a little steep financially, and I don't know that I can afford to have three up there. Secondly, Jimmy is a deaf boy, and I don't know whether you'd want him up there or whether we would want him up there. And Mr. Frank replied to both questions. He said, well, in the first place, he says, you got a couple nice boys up there, and we'd like to have one more, even though he's deaf. We'll try him out. We'll pick him up on a conditional basis, and if he likes it and we like him, we'll keep him, and if not, why, okay. So, secondly, the financial aspect, you go out and get me a few campers, and I'll make it right with you. We'll reduce the price that you have to pay considerably if you get me enough campers. So just tell your son's friends and your friends, and so I thought, well, that's not a bad deal, we'll give it a whirl. So Jane and I did that, and we had exceptionally good success. I think there was a fellow named Ed Hamlin that lived in Bexley that time, and he was signing up boys right and left, and he was Mr. George Frank's star salesman. So we were about next in line there, and we signed up, I think, one summer there, second summer we were involved in that procedure. We had about six campers we signed up for Mr. Frank. So he gave us virtually free tuition on one of our boys, and as far as Jimmy Estabrook was concerned, he learned how to wrestle at Kewanee, learned how to play soccer up here, and it gave him a tremendous amount of self-confidence, self-esteem. So he was very successful, and Mr. Frank came to me after the first summer, and he said, Walter, I want to tell you something. He says, I was in doubt about taking Jimmy up here, but not only has Jimmy done well for himself up here, but he's been a tremendous positive influence on the whole camp. Mm-hmm. And you know, this is probably one reason that Jane and I became so fascinated with what Kiwanee could do for kids, and our own two oldest sons did beautifully up here, and then Jimmy did exceptionally well also, and the fact that he was deaf was sort of an added reason for us to evaluate the experience especially highly for him.
Do you remember what year John first came up?
Yes, I do, because John was just up here recently, and John was here in 1959, his first summer. And I think Richie came up about 61, and then Jimmy must have been two or three years after that.
I guess we would have been here in 59. I would have remembered John.
Now, yes.
I know I remember Rich in 61.
I wasn't
sure what the first year.
Yeah, well, John just told me this past weekend he was up here and with his wife and two little daughters and our grandchildren, and they Don and I just chatted a little bit, and it came out in the conversation that 1959 was his first summer up here.
Well, as we look at this now, maybe before we get into too much into your much more involved period with Kiwanee's history, are there any other impressions of people like, say, Chief Marshall that you recall in working as a counselor or even as a camper in particular, for one? And there may be others that you might want to maybe give a little bit of a thumbnail sketch for some of these individuals who certainly I haven't had an opportunity to get to know.
Right, I'd be delighted to. Now, Chief Marshall was a wonderful person. My understanding is that he was still ice skating well into his 90s and died a few years back, not far from the century mark. Excuse me, but when Chief Marshall was up here, he was director of activities, and he was not young then. I think by Kiwanee counselor standards, he was pushing 70 at that point. He must have been late 60s. But he headed up the Katahdin trips and did a wonderful job as far as director of activities. And we used to call him, his initials were H.C. Marshall, and we used to call him Hyper Clipboard Marshall, because he always carried a clipboard with him. And wonderful person. And of course, Rafe Marshall was his son, the one I mentioned earlier there. And then other people I think that made a huge impression upon me and made me feel as though Kiwanee was a very special place in my life. The presence of Dean Miller and Colonel Sweet. Now, Colonel Sweet, Colonel was just a nickname. Sidney Sweet was, as I mentioned before, was Dean of the Cathedral in St. Louis, but he was up there several summers. Dean Miller a good many summers too, and both those gentlemen were here in the era of 1934 to 39 when I was here. And I would see these guys get out there and play tennis or play softball or other activities, and they had so much spirit to them, and then they were good athletically. And I looked up to them and felt that they were very fine men. And then I would hear one or both of them go out to Bass Rock and stand up on the rock and preach a sermon, and they got through to me. I think they made a lasting impression upon me because they had so many wonderful things to say to inspire boys and young men and young women. There weren't as many young women around then as we have today, but they were just great, and I looked up to them, respected them, liked them, and admired them. And I think that they had a big influence upon me as well as upon literally thousands of other kids that were up here at that time and young counselors.
Well, I was just looking back, thinking back on it. I did know Chief Marshall.
You did?
Yes, yeah. He was still here. In fact, I interviewed him when I was considering a topic for my master's thesis at Ohio State University, because he was very active in the beginning of the junior high school movement, and Columbus was on the map as the first place where the junior high school program began. So, following his retirement from here, I did get together with him when he was about 80, and as you say, he still had a lot of fire and spirit.
A lot of zip.
Right, right. Other people, of course, like Howell Wendell, come into the discussion. I don't know whether he was active when you were here, your first round.
Yes, he was here a couple of the years that I was here, and was in charge of the rifle range. Mm-hmm. A large gentleman.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Right. Well, I can remember one incident that was, well, I don't know if you pulled it today, I think you'd be probated or cast in the jug or something, but in those days there were maybe a few more pranks. And you've perhaps heard of I don't mean lethal auto bombs, but the play auto bombs, you know what I mean? George Frank and Mr. George Frank and Mr. Wendell got in George Frank's car out near the athletic field one morning, and some of the especially mischievous counselors had placed one of these play auto bombs. And as soon as you hit the starter, it goes off and it makes a noise like the car is really going to blow up. And Mr. Wendell, being the size he was, George Frank was pretty good, a hearty eater also. So they evicted from that automobile as fast as I've ever seen anyone get out of a car. And it was all this whistling and noise and great volume of noise going off, and boy, I'll tell you, Mr. Frank and Howell Wendell just got out of there nothing flat. And of course, everybody standing around laughing, and I don't think they appreciated it.
No,
I don't blame them.
Was that attributed to the Duke of Zanzibar or something like that?
Along that line, yes. The Duke of Zanzibar had something to do with that. And I think they... He laid claim to that, and of course no one knew the true identity of the Duke, so that remained a mystery from now on to time eternal.
But you had water meets and athletic types of meets during those
years.
Yes,
they did. They had, I think, maybe perhaps even more water meets in those days. Of course, we had the war canoes then, and I'm very happy to announce that next season, the season of 1987, we will have the two war canoes that we purchased at auction reconditioned to the point where we can put them in service and have the war canoe races again. As you know, the original war canoes were destroyed by the weight of the snow on the roof and the wreck ball caving in. And I think we've been without war canoes for, how many years would you say, 20, 25 years?
Yes, I'd say 25 years close. I think it was in the mid-50s that that occurred. And that was certainly considered a great loss. And I thought it was past the time when we'd ever see them again. So even seeing them in their condition as they are now is certainly... brings the spirits up a great deal. The play nights, and just thinking in terms of other traditions. How long had they been dressing up in whites for Sunday, for instance? That was something that was going on when I first came here in 44.
Okay.
Was that something that you recall having seen instituted, was it always going on?
Well, it went on, to the best of my knowledge, for many years until approximately 15 years ago. John Dietrich, Big John, we call him, was on the scene as assistant director. And Big John was always very emphatic about wanting the boys to wear their whites, just like George and Raymond Frank insisted. And I think the reason we got away from it is that the mothers complained that they weren't able to locate white ducks. Uh-huh. That's one reason that we got away from that. And so we gradually evolved into a situation where it was not required anymore to wear whites on the Sunday services. And now I think we do request that the campers try to look fairly decent out there, but we haven't made that a hard and fast rule anymore. So they sort of gradually drifted away from the original concept of
I just was wondering when they started, you know, whether that was something, starting in the '20s, they may have been more rugged activities, and perhaps there was no requirement of that. But that was just one.
It was when I was here.
It was
all the time. 1934 through 39, they had whites. And as you'll know, recognize from the pictures, the picture of the entire camp, the counselors are all dressed in white. Mm-hmm. In those days, you know, we had a camp uniform, too.
Yes, I do.
They had a Camp Kiwani short sleeve shirt, jersey-like shirt, and shorts to go with it. And that was the camp uniform. Well, we got away from that apparently down the road somewhere.
Mm-hmm. Right. No longer was that the case when I came in 44.
Mm-hmm.
What about Hal Myers? Do you have any special thoughts or remembrances?
Yes, of Hal? I do. He's one of my current golfing buddies. Okay. And Hal Myers, I think of as a marvelous drummer. Mm-hmm. Boy, could he beat those drums. And then Hal, of course, was in charge of the skit nights up here and had a wonderful ability to direct and lead and execute the lodge stunts for the various lodges. And also, during the 1930s, Hal was the production engineer for running off several camp plays.
Mm-hmm.
And I can still remember he talked me into taking part in a play called Trouble in Tunnel 9. And a bunch of miners out there, and there was a lot of loot that was stolen and buried, and it was a big farce, but it was a lot of fun. And I think Hal did an exceptionally good job in generating interest in dramatics in Kiwani in the 1930s. And to the best of my knowledge, it has not been approached since, as far as the enthusiasm for this type of an activity. Now, of course, we still have our lodge stunts, and two nights from now, we're going to have that again here. Wednesday night is stunt night here, and there's going to be a wonderful first. We're going to have about 8 of the ladies in Kiwani this summer who are going to put on a tap dancing review, and boy, I've seen the preliminary on it, and it is something you do not want to miss.
Oh, great. Well, I know there was the plays were still a big thing in the 40s when I was here, because I was in 2 or 3 of them.
Myself. Oh, yeah.
And they did memorize their lines, and they were, you know, very professional, and Franny had some books for the younger kids so that you could read something, and the younger children could act it out, pantomime type of thing. Well, I was just, you know, is there anyone else? I guess, do you have any special impressions of either Raymond or George in those early years? I don't know whether you can separate from your work more closely with George later, but I just was wondering if there was anything for the record that you thought of.
Yes,
for either
I
of them.
Can recall, I knew George better than Raymond because George was the Ohio Frank, and I knew him much better, but on the other hand, I did get to know Raymond pretty well. And I can recall a conversation that I had with Raymond Frank when I was about my second summer up here. We had a little trouble with profanity in the cabin. It couldn't have been the Eagles, because I don't think they were that profane, but it must have been about my third summer when I was maybe in Birch or something like that. About 11, 12-year-old boys, and they were using some pretty bad words. So I wasn't able to control it. So I asked Mr. Raymond Frank, and he said, well, I'll come in and talk to the boys. So he did. And I can remember what he said. I don't know how much weight we carry today, but he said, well, boys, you know, everybody knows those words, you know, it isn't smart to use them. And he said, I think, you know, if you could start a custom when you felt like swearing instead of cussing it up a storm on the cuss words, why, just say asparagus or spinach or mashed potatoes or something like that.
Yeah, uh-huh.
So I don't know whether, I don't remember that it actually worked or not, but he did dangle that little bit of suggestive procedure in front of the boys.
Uh-huh.
Now, as far as George Frank goes, I had many incidents with George. Of course, I got to know George as we became more closely connected with Camp Kewaunee and ultimately became part of the ownership of the camp. George was by nature a real horse trader.
Mm-hmm.
He had that reputation locally in the Weld area, and he also, I soon learned, lived up to that reputation when we attempted to make arrangements to purchase the camp from George.
Uh-huh.
Because George Frank, at the point where we were about ready to make some sort of an offer, either from us to him or from him to us, he took every single building in the Kewaunee compound, and he took every single piece of equipment and put a value on it.
Mm-hmm.
And his value was inflated about five times over what we thought it was worth.
Yeah.
Now, what the actual value was, who knows, but we negotiated with Mr. George Frank for a solid year before we came to any kind of terms about deciding what the price for Kewaunee mm-hmm. should be. And I think another reminiscing that I have about George, when I was first in here about 16 years ago, as the director of Camp Kewaunee, Mr. George Frank was still actually serving the first 3 years after we purchased the camp from him.
Mm-hmm.
He was still serving in the capacity of like a managing director.
Mm-hmm.
And he really pretty much ran the show. And I can recall sitting in when a boy would come in and Mr. Frank would say, all right now, young man, I understand that you don't like it up here and you want to go home. And Mr. Frank would pat the boy on the back and he'd say, you're not a quitter. You're not going to leave this place. There's no way you're going to be a quitter. And he just would emphasize that, and he would pretty darn clever at talking the boy out of it and convincing the boy that he should stay around and get the best out of the investment that his parents had made for him up here.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe you want to go ahead, Walter, while you're on the second phase of your getting involved.
Well,
I know
I'll
that Jane
that.
Was involved, of course, a good deal too. And
yes,
if you'd like to kind of follow through. I know many of us who were so thankful that you were willing, you and Jane were willing to carry on the tradition of the camp, and so I think this is a very important factor to kind of get down in the record.
Be glad to, Ed. Now, the as I mentioned before, George had been very kind to provide Jane and me with a nice scholarship for one or two of our boys, since I was able to, along with the help of my wife and our sons, gain increased enrollment for him in the Columbus and the Bexley area because we had some contacts there. So one summer, George said, he said, "You know, you've done a nice job signing up boys. You come on up to Kewaunee, and we're going to provide a place for you to stay. So that's fine. Mr. Frank would be glad to do that. So you bring your family up." So we did. We came up and we stayed in the cabin, which is today known as the Green Cabin. Uh-huh. It's directly above this Pine Point. It's out on Pine Point. It's the higher one of the two at the down at the end of Pine Point. So we had that cottage for about 2 weeks one summer. And this was, let's see if I can get the timing on this, but it had to be about 1968. And because our charter for our new corporation reads 1969, so it was about a year ahead of then.
I see.
Might have been 67 or 68. So we were here, and Judge Scarlett was up here that year, and John Marble came over from Dixfield, and Mr. Frank at that point had lost his brother and was making noises like he might want to pass along the gavel to somebody else to help run camp. And so we had a big meeting in the shop one night. And Judge Scarlett came to it. Don Wambaugh was there. He came to it.
Oh, good.
And it seems to me that Herb Birch was up there. And Jane and I. And I can't recall whether Dick Miller was there, or Hal Myers was there at that time. I think possibly Hal Myers may have been up there too, but I can't recall exactly the number of people that were there. There must have been 8 or 10 of us. So we sat around and chatted, and we said, "Well, now George Frank has been making comments as though he would like to retire, he would like to sell the camp and the inn and the whole ball of wax." So we discussed it, and we just made an informal discussion, and we decided that we would make him an offer. So we did contact him on this. We didn't come up with any kind of an immediate offer, but we did tell him that we were interested. And then, of course, it wasn't long after that, two or three months later, that he presented us with a personal appraisal of what he thought the camp was worth. And as I say, we all felt that it was highly inflated. So we did some negotiating with Mr. Frank for at least a year before we came to any terms. But what got Jane and me going on this, I think basically, was the fact that our own boys had done so well up here, and we got then I had had happy experiences up here, and I'm sure that my good wife thought I was 100% off my rocker, and probably still does, but she was understanding enough to realize that it meant a lot to me, and so she went along with this. So we had this meeting with these people, and then we exchanged some letters afterward. Now, another fellow whom I failed to mention is Ed Tullis. I think he was there.
Yes.
At that initial meeting also.
Oh,
And Ed was one of the original promoters of the changeover in management. And actually it was John Marble and Ed Tullis and myself that got this thing going and finalized it. And John Marble, being an attorney, was able to put it into writing for us and make the presentation to Mr. George Frank. And he eventually met, he didn't meet our terms, but we arrived at the middle somewhere. So it was an equitable agreement. And that's really how it got started. And then when we got down to the final negotiations, we sat around in a group, those of us that were in the position of being purchasers of Camp Kewaunee and the Kewaunee Inn, and we all looked at each other and we said, well, someone has got to take over for George Frank. Who could it be? Well, we all said, no, not I. And they asked me two or three times, and I said, well, no, I have a job. I'm on the road for a steel company, and I make a reasonably good income, but I don't think I could afford to just give that up, because I have a young family and college ahead of us and all that. So the other members of our group prevailed upon me to go to my employers and ask them if they would oblige by permitting me to come up here a little extra time. And actually, that's what I did, and it worked out. My employers, being with a small company, I was able to do this. And they agreed to let me come up here strictly on a year-to-year basis and spend a little bit of extra time. I was at first up here the first two or three weeks of camp, then back in my territory for a couple of weeks in Ohio in the middle of the summer, in Ohio, West Virginia, and Kentucky, and then the final two or three weeks of camp, so I was back up here again. So I was able to participate to that extent after we did agree on the terms of the sale. But as I mentioned before, the first 3 years, George Frank was really in charge, and we were sort of in a learning capacity from him. Now,
this was started, in
69 then? 1969 was the first year of the new corporation called Kewaunee Incorporated that took over from Frank Brothers Incorporated.
I see.
And that, I believe, was Jane's second year at the Kewaunee Inn, I-N-N. And Jane then became the manager of the inn along with Lydia Dietrich as her number one assistant, and they ran the inn for several summers. And then, of course, we determined after so many years that the inn, lovely as place as it is, was still pretty much of a financial drag upon the total operation of the camp and the inn together. So in effect, the camp was subsidizing the inn financially.
Yes, that had always been the case.
Yes, I think so.
Very few years was that not the case, so I can see why you were concerned about that.
So that is why eventually we decided that we would be wise to sell the inn, which is what we did. And then, of course, we have since then pumped a large portion of the funds from the sale of the inn back into the camp. And this was needed after so many years. The various facilities were tending to deteriorate and needed updating and replacing.
Right.
Everything from plumbing to tennis courts, to basketball, to rifle range, to the fort, and many other areas.
Good. Well, that I think to have that on the record is very good. I would like to pin down a few maybe interesting incidents that maybe you might be able to reflect on if you could, Walt.
Mm-hmm.
Or now that Jane is here, we'd like to get a few impressions from her if she would like.
Great.
But I would think that many of us who knew G.R. very well, and Raymond, of course, before he passed away, began to wonder, you know, how would someone actually step in and run a camp as you and Jane did? And I was wondering whether any sorts of incidents with parents or with counselors or perhaps with G.R. That might be interesting to share, for you to share for the rest of us.
Well, I'm going to call upon Jane to help me with that one.
Probably so many. You don't know which ones you want to talk about, but
can you think of any specific ones that would be good to share, Jane?
Well, I'm not just quite sure.
Jane, if you...
What you're driving at.
Well, I think that when you get a group of individuals together, Jane, to run a corporation, mm-hmm. and especially when you're dealing with a gentleman who was in his 80s, and who we all knew very closely. I personally did, mm-hmm. working in the office and being there in Bexley, I knew G.R. very well, that there might be some interesting human insights about the running. For instance, were there discussions on whether the coming of the chief should remain a traditional program? Were there questions on counselors, maintenance of the buildings? I just wonder whether there were certain kinds of incidents, humorous or otherwise, that you might just want to have kind of, because we each of us is picture ourselves. Mm-hmm. What if I would have been
right.
The Esterbrooks in attempting to maintain something that I dearly loved so much as Camp Kewaunee, and yet what might have occurred that would have perhaps jarred my determination to do that?
I think the most we tried to keep all the traditions as far as ceremonies and programs and his ideas, which he formed the camp on, which are basically very sound, the fun with a purpose and finish what you start and so forth. As far as changes, there comes a time where there has to be changes in buildings or grounds, and since he had designed them all,
uh-huh.
it was most difficult to make any change,
mm-hmm.
even though it was an update or an improvement. Once they were done,
mm-hmm.
he accepted them fairly gracefully and thought they were an improvement. But it was not accomplished without comment.
Mm-hmm.
And
right.
Those times were sometimes a little difficult. As far as staffing and so on, I think there were a great many details of which he was vastly relieved he did not have to do anymore.
I see. Uh-huh.
He had done them for a great many years, and some things became a burden rather
uh-huh.
than a pleasure. He always enjoyed seeing people who had been associated with the camp
uh-huh.
through the years, and visiting with them, and reminiscing. But and he liked to be a part of actual decisions, but in a great many occasions he would say to Walter, you do as you wish,
uh-huh.
which was pretty fair.
Uh-huh.
But he was a stubborn man.
Uh-huh.
And he didn't have a Landrin job for nothing. I think that in any case, sometimes those things are hard.
Did he continue helping get campers?
Yes, he did.
So that mm-hmm. was a help, I suppose. And
right.
of course,
mm-hmm.
Weren't things a little difficult for a period of time after Raymond passed away as far as getting Eastern boys? Wasn't that something that kind of had to be... I know Herb eventually filled the breach, but I'm
yes.
not sure whether that occurred immediately after Raymond passed away.
I think that's true. It was a transitional period, and fortunately for the continuing of the geographical distribution, which today is almost the same, one-third from New Jersey, one-third from Ohio, and one-third worldwide. It was difficult at first, but fortunately for Kewaunee, Mr. Herb Birch stepped in there not too long after Raymond's death and took over and has done an excellent job ever since, and still is. I think that Mr. George Frank was the type of an individual, because of the fact that he had, along with his brother, run the camp for so many, many years. And I have heard him say this. He just could not let go, even though he classified himself after the first 3 years. He was pretty much running Kewaunee as the director, and then he requested that he be given the title of associate director.
Uh-huh.
And he did the brochure, and that we did at that point in time, we did pretty much everything else.
Uh-huh.
And so this was a very difficult thing for him to do, and Bates has told me many times that George would say, "I just can't let go."
Mm-hmm.
And it's instinctive with him to run the camp for 40, 50 years, and he just was not able to.
Right.
But it was very difficult for him to pass the reins along to someone. Let's see. Is it on yet?
It is on now.
Okay.
Right, it's fine. We're just continuing now talking with Walt Estabrook on his reminiscences of Kewaunee, and especially his taking over the reins, leadership, giving the leadership that was required at the close of the 1960s. And it was, I think, interesting to get your personal impressions of how it was to work with GR. I think all of us, you know, were wondering about this over the years, and it would be very natural, I think, as you say, for someone to hold on to the reins as long as he could, but the fact that he even asked, I guess, to be called an associate director showed that he realized that he did want to have an excuse to back away somewhat. And so what, after the first 3 years, then he continued being up here, I guess, until his death.
Right.
So let's say 3 years on to 69 would have meant that by 72 he was supposed to be backing away,
mm-hmm.
and yet the fire and was 77.
Right.
So he continued another 5 years.
Mm-hmm.
To be in evidence, and of course, when Mary and I started coming back, John coming up in 73 from Spokane, Washington, and then my moving to Connecticut, we began coming back in 74,
mm-hmm.
and I guess we saw George still sitting there at his desk in the office with you, and so are there any other individuals? We of course will be talking, I'm sure, many times beyond this evening, but I was just wondering, maybe in closing, if there were any other individuals that you found that gave you a great deal of assistance in your first 5, 6, 7 years up to maybe GR's death or whatever you care to say, that we might want to get on the record. You mentioning Ed Tullis, for instance. Mm-hmm. Now, I know that Henry Blau was very close to the Tullises.
Right.
And frankly, I did not realize that that Ed had been that much involved with the formation of the current arrangements. And you mentioned Bates, of course, and Herb Birch. Are there any other individuals that perhaps you would like to mention that were very helpful to you in those very early years?
I think we've hit most of them, Ed. I would say that in addition to what we've already mentioned about Bates, that he was a vital factor in our first years because when we went out on interviews to line up new campers, new prospects, it was a standard procedure. I was strictly a spectator for the first year or so. Mr. George Frank took his 16 millimeter equipment and had his movies and showed those, and Bates did the narrating, and I just listened and watched.
Uh-huh.
And it was quite an experience. I was the driver. I drove them. And, yeah. And I think our biggest problem was in trying to get Bates to cut it off because he was a long distance talker.
And, right.
And as you know, now Bates was a marvelous person to sign up campers, and he, just like Herb Birch or George Frank, they sold the prospects on enthusiasm. And but Bates would get wound up and get off the track, and George and I would have to shut him off. that was quite fun. We enjoyed that, and then eventually George got away from it. And Bates and I would go out together and make calls on prospects. And then in the last few years here, Bates has not been able to do it either, because he will be 90 years old on the 18th of August.
Is that right?
Yeah. Right. In another couple of weeks here, he'll be 90 years old.
Correct.
And he has quite a burden with his wife and so forth, so he doesn't go out anymore, but I have been fortunate in having Jane, my wife, help me on this now. So we do the solicitation for new campers together. But to answer your question, let me see if I can think of anybody else. Yes, Ed Tullis was especially instrumental in the early formation of the new corporation. And I would say it was the three, Tullis, Marble, and myself, that got it off the ground. And it has, of course, what happened when we formed the new corporation, we made one bum decision. We decided at a board of directors meeting that the corporation should carry life insurance on me. Well, they have. And they really should have taken that on Tullis and Marble, because
the corporation
would be a lot richer today if they had, because unfortunately, John Marble died within about a year after we incorporated, and then Ed Tullis has been deceased for a number of years also. So, of the original three, I'm the only character left of the trio. But see if I can think of any other persons that were vital. Of course, I can't underestimate the value of Mr. Herb Birch, who has just been a marvelous addition to the Kewaunee scene, and has kept up for many years that ratio of Tenafly and Englewood and other New Jersey boys, and still signs up. He and I have a friendly competition every year. Some years he'll beat me, and some years I beat, last year Jane and I beat him. But we now have, you know, the Spanish contingent, and you might want to know how that got started.
Yes, I think that would be an interesting thing.
Well, there was a camp in existence called Camp Idlewild about 10 or 12 years ago, and the brother of the director, his name was Bill Royce, who was the director of Camp Kiniwatha in Wilton.
Yes, I recognize the name.
And we knew Camp Kiniwatha because of the proximity to Weld. He used to have sort of a sister camp over there. And Mr. Bill Royce informed Jane and me that his brother, the director of Camp Idlewild, which is on Lake Winnipesaukee, very successful camp, that the brother was just going to close it up. So I called the brother up and asked him if I could buy his list. And he said, no, it's not for sale. But he said, I know Camp Kiwani. I'll be glad to recommend Kiwani to some of my clientele if they ask me. So I followed that up with a letter and offered Mr. Royce, that is the one who was the head of Camp Idlewild, a commission if he would enroll any boys for us. Well, I never expected to hear, but a few months later I received a letter from this lady in Spain, and she said, I have four sons, and I have heard through Mr. Royce of Camp Idlewild where my sons were, that he's not opening next season. Would you send me your brochure? So I thought that's a waste of postage to send it all the way to Madrid, Spain, but I did. And this lady's name is Monique Ridruejo, and she later became a good friend of Jane's and mine because she investigated three or four camps and decided on Kiwani and enrolled all four of her boys that first summer, about 10 years ago. And then, shortly after she enrolled her boys, she said, I have other friends who are interested, and asked me to send brochures to them, which we did. But I thought, again, it's a waste of postage. However, that first year, I think we had 7 or 8 Spanish boys, and we've had them ever since. This year it's down slightly. We have 10, and some years we've had as much as 15, 16. But our Puerto Rican following has gone up a little bit this year, and we received a marvelous letter from Carlos Del Valle, who is an ophthalmologist in San Juan, Puerto Rico, and this is our first application for 1987. This came in, and we're very happy to have that, and we have an advance application set up now where we give a deduction on the June billing if they get their application in real early.
Well, that's interesting then. So there was a transfer then with the Spain boys, then certain families in Puerto Rico heard about the camp, and so you're expanding there. Well, I remember back in the 40s and 50s that we had some families from Cuba. So there has been some tradition over the years for Spanish-speaking families to send, I should say, Spanish-speaking families, because many of these boys speak English quite fluently. So
they certainly do.
And that's an advantage. Well, unless there are any other thoughts about that period up to the time of the fire, the great fire, and the accident for George Frank, I think maybe that's, we've covered enough territory for the evening.
That's just fine. Would you want me to add a final comment about the royalty we had here, or do you have any information on that?
That would be helpful if you would want to.
Okay, well, the Spanish families that we signed up increased, and then they're quite influential business people, and one of the families, the Fusker family, one of their sons was quite friendly with the Prince of Spain. So we, 4 summers ago, had the Prince of Spain here, son of Juan Carlos and Queen Sofia, the King and Queen of Spain. And additionally, his two cousins from Greece, who were princes from Greece but lived in England in exile, accompanied the Prince of Spain. So we had three princes on the Kwani scene 4 summers ago, and they brought 5 bodyguards with them, and that was quite an experience. I can recall when the colonel in charge of the bodyguards came to me with his attaché case and said, "I'd like to settle the account with you, Mr. Estabrook." And I said, "Fine, step into the office." And he proceeded to pull out $100 bills and count out for all three princes somewhere between $5,000 and $6,000 worth of cash.
Oh my God.
So that was the experience.
Don't have that happen very often.
Not very often, no. Happened to be the 4th of July weekend, and I didn't know where to put all that money. So somebody, I think Nan Belskis, suggested, she has a safe in the camp store, but she said, "Well, I don't want that much in my safe." So she said, "Why don't you put that in your refrigerator?" And so this is what I did. Yeah, I put it in the refrigerator. Now, maybe that's where a thief would look, but it was safe there in the refrigerator. We had it in some kind of a food dish just stacked in there. And
camouflaged,
right. Thank you. But that's an interesting sideline commentary on the Spaniards. And they've been, they're very fine boys, are quite athletic, and most of them pretty darn good boys. We have 3 from Venezuela this year, too, from Caracas.
Caracas, Venezuela. We've had some from Venezuela over the years.
I think we have.
So that's kind of growing a little bit there, too.
So you have the information recorded elsewhere on the fire, right? So
well, we just haven't gotten that far along. I know the time is kind of running out this evening. Maybe some other time we could sit down and pick up from the fire and go on to...
All right, Ed, that's fine. I appreciate the chance to do this. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Walter, and we appreciate very much getting this on the tape.
Right, sir.